From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Italy's parliamentary elections have ended in a deadlock. Voters there backed two populist parties, one on the left, the other on the right. The left-leaning Five Star Movement received the biggest share of the vote in Sunday's election. A right-wing party, the League, got the second largest share, and now it will try to form a coalition government with other right and center-right parties. This election could ripple through the European Union. So let's turn to the BBC's James Reynolds in Milan. And James, this populist Five Star Movement, a relative newcomer in Italian politics, so let's start there. How did they manage to get the most votes?
By appealing to the poorer south of the country and by appealing to the country's young people who want jobs. If you go to the south, you find that in some regions, every other young person is looking for work. Earlier this year, I actually went on a bus with some young people from the south. They were all going off to compete for a single nursing contract. There were hundreds competing for 1 6-month contract. And that gives you an indication of the kind of ground that Five Star was able to work with.
That's also the place where many of the migrants coming from Africa first set foot in Italy. I imagine that played a big role in this, too.
It has, and particularly it's played a big role here in the north of Italy. I'm speaking to you from Milan, of course, where the League Party has done well. And remember this, a few years ago, the League wasn't even called the League. It was called the Northern League. It wanted to split Italy to get rid of the south and to become a prosperous central or northern European country. It now wants to lead the country it once wanted to split. That's the fundamental change which has taken place in the League. Essentially, it's swapped enemies. It used to have as its enemy Southerners. It now has its enemy illegal migrants, and it's become the leading anti-illegal migrant voice in this country.
Well, this is amazing. On the one hand, you have the populist Five Star Movement. On the other hand, you have the far-right party, the League, as you mentioned. What happened to the center?
It has dissipated, as it often does in Italy, in the search for new faces. Remember, the entire country had to realign itself in the mid-90s after corruption scandals. Italy is used to having this experiment where it gets fed up with the people in the center for failing to provide jobs, and it looks for new voices. At one stage in the past, Silvio Berlusconi was the new voice. He didn't do so well in this election. In 2014, from the centre-left, Matteo Renzi was the new voice. He did very badly in this election. The new voices are prevailing at the moment, but they'll, of course, realise what happens to a new voice, it becomes the old voice, and it gets washed away in the future.
Well, and all these voices now have to form a broader coalition. How's that shaping up?
Almost impossible to tell at the moment, because Five Star has staked its claim. One of its officials says, everyone should come and talk to us. The League here in Milan has staked its own claim, saying we should lead the government. Those are the two public claims at the moment. Those are the two rival claims. It may be that other politicians, perhaps even the defeated politicians, are just biding their time, thinking that if these two parties, newer parties, don't really know how to build coalitions, other parties might try and rally around. A big role will be played by Italy's ceremonial president, Sergio Mattarella. The presidency in Italy exists for almost one thing only: coalition forming. In a few weeks' time, the president will call the parties together, and he may then choose one person to form a government.
Now, the both of these parties are very skeptical of the European Union. How is the rest of the continent viewing this election?
I think with the degree of unease, particularly, of course, in Brussels, where they have watched governments with anti-EU postures rise in recent years. But of course, the bigger question is this: whether or not Five Star and the League will eventually combine in a single Eurosceptic government. Bear in mind this: neither party is campaigning or has campaigned to leave the EU. They have both criticized the EU. They want a better relationship from their point of view with the EU. But it's not about leaving Brussels. It's about getting better deals.
Steve Bannon, who engineered Donald Trump's win in the United States, was in Rome ahead of the election. He reportedly hinted at his support for the League. According to Italian press reports, Bannon said the election could open the way for a populist wave across Europe. I mean, what is the significance of having a man like Steve Bannon in Italy?
Well, clearly, it creates a huge amount of attention. I don't think it's a particular surprise that his degree of support might fall towards the five-star movement, given his views, given their views. Whether or not Italy is a bellwether for other countries, it's very difficult to tell. Just a year ago, I was in France watching Emmanuel Macron take office, a pro-EU politician who wants to reinvigorate the EU. So just because an event happens in a powerful European country doesn't mean that similar events will happen in other countries of the same size.
What is the difference between Italy and a country like Germany or France, as you mentioned, that also dealt with these populist movements but didn't quite see the same success?
In some ways, you almost have to throw it round. The populist movement here has become as mainstream as anything else. In other words, it's not Five Star is not a bunch of wild populists who are going to come in and tear up the furniture. They haven't become a party of the establishment. They control town councils in Turin and in Rome. They've already had a number of MPs. They have built themselves into a mainstream party already. There are elements of populism in how they make their decisions, but actually, possibly, we all underreport the degree to which they have become part of the mainstream.
That's the BBC's James Reynolds in Milan. James, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Well, the Academy Awards are called hashtag Oscars So White, but last night Jordan Peele became the first African-American to win Best Original Screenplay for Get Out, his demonic story of seemingly progressive aging whites taking over the bodies of young blacks.
This means so much to me. I stopped writing this movie about 20 times because I thought it was impossible. I thought it wasn't going to work. I thought no one would ever make this movie. But I kept coming back to it because I knew if someone let me make this movie, that people would hear it and people would see it.
Gene Demby from NPR's Code Switch is here. And Gene, historic moment, or are people disappointed Peele didn't win more awards?
I mean, yeah, there's a way in which the screenplay Oscar often becomes seen as sort of a half a loaf. As in the case of Get Out, the movie was nominated for Best Picture and for screenplay. And so one of the ways you split the difference there, at least this is the conventional thinking, is that you give the screenplay award to the screenwriter. That way the movie is awarded in some way without having it to give it one of the big, big, big awards.
You know, just staying with the writing for a second, I mean, it's not nothing. I mean, we're reading Stefani Robinson, who writes for Television's Atlanta, about research that only 4.8% of TV writers are black, and that there are so few employed writers across the industry. Mm-hmm. And she says, you know, it's not just opportunity, but it's about disrupting the traditional white-centric narrative. And I just can't imagine a white screenwriter coming up with Peele's concept.
Yeah, Get Out is a really, really provocative movie. And it's sort of remarkable in a number of ways, right? I mean, one, it was sort of a B movie that was made with a really small budget that gathered momentum as time went on. Like, everything about Get Out was kind of a long shot in getting to where it ended up on the Academy Awards stage. And so there is a way in which the story of Get Out and its trajectory is really remarkable, especially because, again, like, the subject matter is so provocative.
Yeah. Well, talk about some other cultural moments. Coco, Pixar's movie about a young Mexican boy, won for Best Animated Feature.
With Coco, we tried to take a step forward toward a world where all children can grow up seeing characters in movies that look and talk and live like they do. Marginalized people deserve to feel like they belong. Representation matters.
And Gene, you also had Guillermo del Toro win Best Director.
How many times have you heard a Best Director winner start a speech, an Oscar speech, with, as a kid growing up in Mexico? So you have a Mexican-American man winning Best Director. You have a movie, an animated movie, about Mexican-Americans or Mexican people winning the Best Animated Feature. And, of course, you know, the lead time for Hollywood movies is so long that they did not plan to land in this cultural moment. But it's really hard to not sort of read all the political subtext into this. Obviously, we're having big policy conversations about DACA and immigration. And so it's hard not to read these movies and the reception of these movies as part of this political conversation.
Well, so, of course, was the Me Too or Time's Up movement in Hollywood, the reaction to the revelations of sexual harassment there. Let's listen to Frances McDormand. She won for Best Actress for Three Billboards.
If I may be so honored to have all the female nominees in every category stand with me in this room tonight, the actors. Meryl, if you do it, everybody else will. Come on.
And at the end, Gene Demby, she called for an inclusion writer. A lot of people are like, what? What's that? What is that?
An inclusion rider is a stipulation in an actor's contract that a movie that they're working on has some set amount of diversity, that people who are producing it are actively putting people of color and women in roles in front of the camera and behind the camera. You know, it was really striking that she was asking for that. You know, she won for Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, a movie that sort of has black people in the most peripheral roles and which has a very blinkered politics around race. But what she was saying was, I think, one of the things that a lot of people who care about inclusion and diversity talk about is that the ways in which white people who have some power and who have some prestige have to use that power to help other people get in the room. The problem is that when it comes to the Oscars, it's not clear that winning an Oscar has the same benefits for women, and especially women of color who win the award. There's not really any sort of traction that happens with their careers following. I mean, Monique, very famously in the last couple of weeks, who won an Oscar for her role in Precious, was fighting with Netflix, who she said lowballed her on a contract. These things happen again and again, and every time there is a big Oscar win, there is a conversation as if, like, oh, this will be the thing that changes everything. And of course, what's telling is that the next time there's a win, we're saying the same thing again.
Gene Demby of NPR's Code Switch, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today, the Florida Senate is considering gun legislation that would arm some teachers and raise the age to purchase a rifle to 21. So the debate over guns carries on after last month's school shooting in Florida. But whenever Americans have this debate, there seems to be a consistent pattern. The conversation breaks down. Each side vilifies the other. Navy veteran Adam Weinstein believes imprecise language is making matters worse. He says words like automatic weapon, clip, assault rifle, magazine, they're just thrown around without understanding. Weinstein writes for Task and Purpose. It's a publication covering military and veterans issues, and he has a concealed carry permit. His gun collection has included an AR-15, a Ruger handgun, a Smith & Wesson pistol. He owns collectibles with his father. Adam, welcome to Here and Now. And as a gun owner, do you think the gun debate in this country is at an impasse?
I think it's absolutely broken down, and I think that language plays a big part in that. You've seen both sides for as long as you can remember. We talked about and argued about assault weapons and what that even meant in the early 1990s and the late 80s. So as long as I can remember, coming to some kind of a consensus on the parlance, or not coming to that consensus and just using language disconnects as a way of building up your own group identity has just been part and parcel of the gun discussion.
So to that point, I want to play two pieces of tape now. The first one is of President Obama, and this is after the Sandy Hook shooting. He's talking about gun control.
We can do a much better job in terms of keeping these magazine clips with high capacity out of the hands of folks who shouldn't have them.
The president, of course, as you know, was slammed for using this term magazine clip, which apparently is not a thing. Most people probably don't know that. And then here's Republican Senator Marco Rubio talking at the recent town hall in Florida after the Parkland shooting. Someone had asked him about magazine capacity.
And I'm glad you asked that question, because I traditionally have not supported looking at magazine clip size. And after this and some of the details I've learned about it, I'm reconsidering that position, and I'll tell you why.
So this is not just an issue of Democrats not knowing the language of guns, but in this case also a Republican who is a very strong proponent of guns in the United States.
Yeah. Again, well, chances are pretty good that when you speak to a politician, they're not going to be so well engaged on this issue as a lot of people are for the parlance. You know, the magazine clip distinction is a very fine one, but it's one that if it comes up in conversation, you almost immediately know that you're speaking to somebody who comes from a different perspective or a different point of view. And it's also hugely fueled by our media and by television and movies. Like, those terms are used interchangeably. A lot of these are used interchangeably, and so we absorb some of those media lessons.
Okay, so tell us, what is the difference between a magazine and a clip, and why it frankly matters?
Right. So a magazine is just a container. It's usually it clips on to your firearm and feeds you fill it with your rounds or your cartridges, and it feeds those rounds into your firearm. A clip is not an enclosure. It just is exactly what it sounds like. A little strip usually that you can use to load certain weapons, not a whole lot, or to load those cartridges into a magazine. So, you know, the common way of thinking of it is a clip feeds a magazine feeds a weapon. Does it matter that much? I'm not sure that it does. Again, I think it's just sort of a cultural signifier of where you're coming from this issue on.
Well, there is a narrative, and you've already touched on this, on the right, that people who are anti-gun are uninformed, that they've never touched a gun. So how in the world do they deserve to have an opinion? But Democrats do own guns. They are engaged with this issue. And they might often say the right's view of things, the facts that the right brings to the table, don't line up with reality. I mean, you have to give them that occasionally, too.
Well, yeah, I'll give you one recent example. So down here after the Parkland school shooting, CNN hosted that town hall forum for a lot of the survivors and their families to speak with political representatives and representatives of the industry. Dana Loesch was there representing the NRA's point of view. And at one point, a mother of a victim in the shooting asks her, how can these weapons that we're talking about be justified under the 1791 Second Amendment? And Loesch cited this British political novelty, the Puckle gun from the 18th century, and a Belton rifle, which is in the Smithsonian, as proof that the Founding Fathers, quote, had fully automatic firearms. Now, I'm writing a book on the Belton, so that I can say that argument's problematic on a bunch of fronts. But she used this term, fully automatic firearms, to describe something that was developed in 1758 that had a piece of flint to fire, and a guy manually used it to maybe get 8 shots out in a minute. If anybody who was a gun control advocate used that term that incorrectly and carelessly, the NRA would jump all over them.
Right. Yeah. So what's the consequence of having someone like the spokeswoman of the NRA using that kind of language?
Well, I mean, it signifies that I think a lot of the language debate is not necessarily a good faith debate among gun owners who are on the Second Amendment NRA side, saying, come understand us, get to know these machines before you want to develop public policy around them. Instead of that, you're getting a lot of, they will never understand us, and we have to maintain our identity as people who know better than everybody else, and we have to fight public policy from the ignorant.
Well, the person who comes to the table and makes a mistake when they're having a conversation with a gun owner could feel personally attacked when that's brought up. It could shut down the conversation. And so I guess what I'm just trying to say is, like, how much responsibility do gun owners have to make sure that they can bring a non-gun owner into the conversation so that you can actually have a productive conversation?
You know, this is one of those things I've never quite understood about the turn that you see in gun culture, certainly since, I mean, those elements of kind of the personal identity and, you know, inability to compromise have always been there. But as a child, I grew up in a community of responsibility and kind of an evangelist community. When you enjoyed shooting sports, you wanted to share them with other people. I covered the NRA annual meeting with my girlfriend, who is a photographer, a couple of years ago, and it was her first opportunity to hold an air gun. And she was totally hooked. And my argument has always been, you know, you have a pastime that it has value when it's used responsibly and when you invite people in to understand it. So I think a lot of the onus right now has to be on the owners and the possessors of this knowledge and this technology to say, here's how it forms a part of our lives. And we may have to disagree on some things, but, you know, I need to help you understand what we're actually talking about.
But there
and
are,
I don't think they're doing that.
Yeah, but, you know, if it's hard for that message to get through if on the other side someone says, I don't want anything to do with any machine that is responsible for having killed 17 innocent people in a school. You know, yeah. It's like if you're against guns, you could understand why somebody doesn't even want to touch them or be told why they're valuable.
You have to. I mean, I lost a wrestling coach in the Parkland shooting. I have known other victims of gun violence. And, you know, I can't imagine looking a person who suffered like that in the eye and trying to explain, you got to get the distinction between an assault weapon and an assault rifle. Because that does seem trivial in the long run to somebody who is literally on the other end of these weapons. And that's a viewpoint that I think isn't taken seriously enough by gun owners.
So this hits close to home for you.
Yeah, that forms the basis of a lot of my reporting and my writing right now, is that I feel a responsibility to talk about what I was raised knowing and the extent to which that's problematic, and the extent to which that really can integrate in a society that can be peaceful and civil and not settle their differences this way. Mm. But eventually every American is going to be touched by this in one way or another, whether they're simply an owner or they know a victim or both.
An NPR Ipsos poll out on Friday showed that 3/4 of people who were polled think that gun laws should be stricter than they are now. Congress does not appear to be able to act upon that. Do you really think that getting the language right around guns on both sides is going to fix that?
Maybe it's the biases of my profession as a journalist. I have to hope that language can be a bridge and rather than a breaker down between people. My concern here is that we have a great opportunity for every time somebody makes a misstep on this terminology, every time somebody betrays a little bit of ignorance, that's an opportunity to have a deeper conversation and a longer conversation. The problem is there's so many incentives on both sides right now for it to be the end of the conversation. You don't understand what I understand. There can be no common ground between us, and that's the problem.
You lost somebody that you know in the Florida shooting. You are a gun owner. Do you want tighter gun controls?
I do. I do think that a large number of the weapons that have passed through my hands over the years are not weapons that need to be as readily available as they are. I do think that we are, as a society, much more prone to enjoying our rights than we are exercising our responsibilities. And I think we need a coherent gun violence policy that acknowledges that. And that's going to require a little bit of effort and a little bit of talk on both sides.
That's Adam Weinstein. He's a Navy vet and a senior editor for Task and Purpose. It's a digital publication that covers military and veteran issues. Adam, thank you for taking the time to have this conversation with us today.
Thank you.
This podcast and following message are sponsored by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? Every business needs great people and a way to find them. Something more than posting your job online and just praying for the right people to see it. ZipRecruiter revolutionized hiring. Their technology finds great candidates for you. It learns what you're looking for, identifies people with the right experience, and invites them to apply to your job. Right now, listeners can try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/here. That's /HERE. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
In Reno, Nevada, a new facility is open to house the pets of people looking for emergency shelter from domestic violence. Bree Zender from Reno Public Radio explains why such a place is even needed.
When Nicole was planning her escape from a physically abusive relationship, leaving behind her dog was not an option. Not only would she miss her dog, she feared her abuser may also hurt the animal.
One evening, my ex came in and ended up pulling a knife on me. And my dog's bark and growl that she let out was literally what kind of snapped him back too. And he eventually left. But I think that had my dog not let out that bark, that I may not still be here today.
Nicole isn't her real name, and we are concealing her voice because revealing her identity may put her in danger. That's the same reason we are not providing details about her dog. Right now, it's staying at a friend's apartment while Nicole is living at the Domestic Violence Resource Center's emergency shelter in Reno. The shelter recently opened a facility called Noah's to accommodate up to 36 animals. This gives survivors of domestic violence like Nicole immediate access to their animals. Nicole's dog will be arriving soon, and some of the first few animals have arrived in the past few weeks. Noah's founder, Stacy Alonzo, says she was inspired because of experiences she had while interacting with survivors while serving as a board member of a women's shelter in Las Vegas.
There was a 19-year-old woman who had the courage to come, and she had a garbage bag and she had a cat carrier. And she, when she learned that she couldn't bring her cat into the facility, she was going back.
Alonzo says it was common for survivors to return to a dangerous situation because they didn't want to leave their pets behind. A national survey from the Center for Women and Families says more than 70% of women seeking safety who have animals report pet abuse in their homes as well. Alonzo modeled this facility after the one she opened in Las Vegas in 2007. At the time, it was the first of its kind in the nation. Denise Yoxheimer directs the DVRC.
So what we want to do as a domestic violence resource center is to remove as many hurdles and obstacles to leaving as possible.
Yoxheimer and Alonzo have been developing this program for the past 3.5 years.
We know that children are an obstacle and a hurdle to leaving in some cases. We know that pets are. We know that financial insecurity is. All of those things work together to create doubt in the minds of survivors who are trying to consider fleeing a dangerous situation.
Yoxheimer says interaction with animals is also an important part of the recovering process for a lot of survivors.
For all the reasons that we love and take comfort from our pets at home, the individuals that we serve who are going through this kind of trauma also appreciate the healing power of pets.
The new facility includes an exam room, a sunroom for cats, a bathing station for dogs, and a small yard for animals to get some exercise. But for Nicole, the survivor we heard from earlier, this shelter is about more than convenience.
Many times women or people that have suffered through these types of situations end up living without the same support systems because the abuser separates us. And so your pet becomes so much more important in your life. And having to surrender or not have the support of that pet can be really detrimental.
Nicole says having a dog nearby brings a missing piece of her life back. For Here and Now, I'm Bree Zender in Reno, Nevada.
Corey Stamper is a rock star lexicographer and editor at Merriam-Webster with a Facebook fan club. Her Ask the Editor videos have thousands of views. Here she's talking about the plural of octopus.
So let's say you're swimming in the ocean and you see some eight-legged cephalopods. You say to your friend, hey, I saw a group of octopuses. And your friend says, hey, you're an ignorant slob. You saw a group of octopi. So is it octopuses or octopi?
Well, it turns out it's both, as Corey reminds us in her 2017 book, Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries, an occasionally profane behind-the-scenes look at writing one. It's out in paperback this week. We spoke when the book first came out, and I asked her to explain how one class helped pique her interest in words.
It was a class on the Old Norse Icelandic family sagas, which, you know, is about as nerdy as you can get. And our professor was explaining how to say this word, and he said there's an odd sound at the end of this name that is called the voiceless alveolar lateral fricative. And I lit up like a used car lot. I thought, I don't know what that is. Fricative, that sounds obscene. Lateral, that means you can aim it. Voiceless, but you say it. So that's the thing that really hooked me on language itself, not just story, not just words, but language.
Yeah. You went on to study Old English and really just dive down, as you say, this rabbit hole. And in fact, you say, I was from that point on a woman obsessed. I traced words across the rough sword and buckler of Old English over the sibilant seesaw of Middle English. You go on to say, I discovered that nice used to mean lewd, stew used to mean whorehouse. I hadn't just fallen down this rabbit hole. I saw it in the distance, ran full tilt at it. The more I learned, the more I fell in love with this wild, vibrant whore of a language. What? Why? Why would you characterize it that way?
Well, English as a language has been stealing words from other languages pretty much since its inception. When we first started speaking the ancestor language of English, which is Old English, we were already stealing words from Latin. We were stealing words from Old Norse. In the, you know, high Middle Ages, we were stealing lots of French words, and we started stealing Italian words. We've just always been a language that kind of sleeps around. And And that's fine. And that's what makes English so beautiful and wonderful and also so frustrating for people who are trying to learn English as either their native language or as a foreign language. I have so much empathy and sympathy for people who are trying to learn English as a foreign language.
Now, you say something in the book that I felt when I started to read it. I thought words were already defined.
Right. Lots of people do. When I tell people what I do for a living, a lot of people say, well, we already have the dictionary. Why do you need to write another one? But old words take on new meanings all the time, and new words come in all the time. And, you know, you got to have somebody who's paying attention to that.
So give us some examples, just some things that you had to wrestle with. Take, thinking offhand, well, the definition of that would be. That I'm spacing because I can't, even though I know the word.
Right. And the thing is the definition of take depends on how you're using it, what its context is. So taking the bus is different than taking the witness stand, is different than taking a number, is different than taking a flyer. So all of those takes have to get cataloged. And the way that lexicographers have always done it is to kind of, we look at all of the accumulated written evidence we have for that word, and then we sort them into piles. It used to be paper piles. Now it's electronic piles based on meaning. And once you start doing that, it gets really difficult to pull something apart and say, okay, I'm going to say that take the witness stand is different from taking the bus. So how is that different? Well, do you step up onto it? Is that the sort of core of the meaning? Well, no. When you take the witness stand, you're being entered into an official record. Okay. Is that really it? When you take the bus, do you get on the bus? Do you get in the bus? Do
you have you steal it?
Yeah, you steal it. You steal the bus. That's what you do.
Well, you know, being inside your head while you do this, I can see how you describe it as coming upon doors that just go out into air and stairs that go nowhere.
Yeah, it really is. You hit a point with, I think, most particularly long entries where you just feel like, I don't speak English anymore. These words don't make any sense to me. I have no idea what they mean. They're in some weird low German dialect. I don't know what I'm doing. It is a really brain-wrenching exercise.
We have to talk about Irregardless, sadly,
yes.
Because that makes your skin crawl and mine too. But you were tasked with responding to an angry email when it was included in the Dictionary One version. And your first response when you got the email was, that's ridiculous, and explain why you were sure it wouldn't be in the dictionary.
To me, Irregardless is just flat out wrong, because that's what I had been told my entire life.
Take us through it. Ear?
Ear. So that's taken from the word irrespective, and regardless is regardless. So it's a blend of irrespective and regardless, and it means regardless.
Right. People really mean to say, regardless of what happened. But why is it in the dictionary?
Because, if you can believe it, this word that everybody has this very specific and vehement dislike of gets used in print a ton. It ends up in edited prose way more than you would think. And it goes back to the late 1700s, I think, is where we've dated it at this point. And I think it actually originated as an emphatic way to say regardless. So yeah. People would say, well, regardless of that and irregardless of the other thing. And that just kind of got flattened when it got into print.
Well, and talk about reader response. I mean, this was one of the cases, and I think you say the spectrum of hatred of irregardless might be unmatched. I mean, you know, what you hear from people when you have to explain why it's in the dictionary, even though you also hate it. And you say that you were prepared for this kind of exchange because once as a bakery assistant, an angry customer picked up an Elmo cake and threw it at your head. And so you were prepared for this. But really, can anything prepare you for how people feel about words?
No, it really can't. People feel so deeply about language. Language is very personal for people. And so words like irregardless, people see them as a personal affront.
Yeah. Well, lots of hard work, lots of tedious work noticed by people who love words when it rubs them the wrong way. But then in 2009, there came this. Here's a little excerpt from the Stephen Colbert Show.
Now, I recently learned that Merriam-Webster's has changed the definition of marriage. It now includes the state of being united to a person of the same sex in a relationship like that of a traditional marriage. That means gay marriage. You know, I'm beginning to suspect that Merriam and Webster were conjugating more than just irregular verbs.
This, of course, was the old Stephen Colbert, the fictional conservative character. But this came at a tough time for you. You'd been the focus of a writing campaign. You happened to be the editor who was assigned a response to the inclusion of gay marriage in the marriage listing. What was that like?
It was rough. This was one of these instances where people feel strongly about language because language is a cultural marker. And their concern was that the dictionary is supposed to be an arbiter of language. Language is what expresses our culture. Therefore, the dictionary must be an arbiter of culture. And if you're going to enter this, then, you know, the Supreme Court will refer to it and the world is just going to fall apart and Noah Webster is spinning in his grave. And it was about 3 solid weeks of email. And it was very rough. And because I had to say, we're not describing the thing, marriage. We're describing a use of the word marriage. And that seems like, you know, hair splitting to a lot of people. But that's what lexicography is. We deal with words, not culture, fortunately for everybody around us, because we're all really awkward nerds.
How awkward is it? You know, you love words. You'd rather sit with words than, it sounds like, just about anything. You've interrupted dinners to take cell phone pictures of the menu for citation files.
I have. My kids hate it.
So how awkward is it, and what's the love?
Inside the office, we find it very collegial and very normal, and people who visit find it very weird because it's a whole bunch of people sitting in cubicles, very quiet, not talking to each other. But, you know, everyone who works there and everyone who does lexicography really does it because it's this beautiful puzzle, and you can't do this work and not love English somehow. Otherwise, it would just drive you insane because it's so tedious and so detail-oriented. But we really all sort of have this strong affection for this language that a lot of people feel is really unlovely and unlovable.
Cori Stamper, last March, her book Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries, comes out in paperback tomorrow.
White House advisors were making the rounds over the weekend to push the president's plan to slap tariffs on imported aluminum and steel, saying they are essential to protect American industries. But U.S. allies around the world are pushing back, and even members of the president's own party are resisting today. A spokesperson for House Speaker Paul Ryan saying the congressman is urging the president not to advance with his plan. Let's bring in Derek Thompson. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, and he joins us now, as he does each and every Monday, from New York City. Hey, Derek, how are you?
Hello there.
So 25% on steel, 10% on aluminum. We've had a couple of days now to kick this around, process what it means. And the consensus from economists is what?
The message from economists is simple. This tariff plan doesn't make any sense. And the reason it doesn't make any sense, according to most economists, is pretty easy to understand. There is a reasonable concern about China dumping steel. And despite that turn of phrase, that doesn't mean like backing up a pickup truck and unloading steel bars in your neighbor's front yard or whatever. It's just a fancy term for subsidizing steel exports, which hurts domestic producers here in the U.S. So there's a simple way to deal with this. The U.S. gets together with its allies, its trading partners, and we collectively pressure China to reduce its capacity. But rather than do that, rather than join our trading partners to pressure China, this policy punishes all of those trading partners when it comes to steel. Canada, Brazil, and South Korea are the top exporters of steel to the U.S. And with this tariff, we're slapping the same tax on them that we're slapping on the Chinese, essentially therefore daring them to tax us right back on our exports to them. So it's creating a needless trade war when the fundamental problem here is much, much better resolved by collective action, joining with our allies rather than punishing them.
Right. It's the trade war with American allies that has so many people scratching their head. We're hearing from the European Commission that Europe will consider countermeasures if this goes forward, targeting Levi jeans, Harley Davidson motorcycles, Kentucky bourbon. Another interesting note from Speaker Ryan's office today, spokesperson said, we certainly don't want to jeopardize the gains of tax reform. Now, that's interesting. Does a tariff on steel and aluminum, just kind of erase the gains of tax cuts by putting a tax somewhere else.
It doesn't erase the gains. I don't want to go that far. It definitely does not erase the gains of tax reform or of the GOP tax cuts. It does, however, essentially raise prices on American consumers. I mean, that's what a tariff is. A tariff is a tax on imports. And if you have a tariff on steel or on aluminum, then you're probably raising costs for people, for any company that uses steel or aluminum, and thereby raising costs on anybody that buys from those companies using steel or aluminum. I was joking to some friends earlier that if, you know, when you combine the Trump budget with its sky-high deficits, and you put that side by side with this plan to start a trade war, which the president says is good and easy to win, you basically have a policy to raise costs across the economy, to raise inflation by any measure possible. High deficits plus low interest rates, plus tariffs galore is a perfect storm for higher prices and maybe wages. I don't think that's Trump's explicit plan here. But if you were the president of the United States and your job was to raise inflation by any means necessary, this is what you would do. It doesn't make it a good plan. I think, you know, out of control inflation, no one considers that good. But that's the only way to sort of tie together all of these ad hoc policies at once.
Well, the president's cabinet secretary, Wilbur Ross, the commerce secretary, is making the case that the tariff on aluminum, for instance, would not actually cost consumers that much. And here he is trying to make the point on CNBC with a can of Campbell's soup in his hand.
In the can of Campbell's soup, there's about 2.6 pennies worth of steel. So if that goes up by 25%, that's about 0.6 of 1 cent on the price of a can of Campbell's soup.
So here's the Trump administration trying to make the point that any increase in consumer goods are, you know, not going to outweigh the benefit to the steel industry, for example. Break down the secretary's argument there. Is he right to point that out about the Campbell's soup can?
It's an unbelievably glib argument. I mean, an aluminum tax is not going to raise the price of an individual soup can by very much, right? I mean, but that's because a soup can is a tiny, tiny, tiny little thing. But what about the can makers and other companies that have to buy hundreds or thousands of tons of aluminum or steel every year in a period of rising labor costs? If you raise the price of aluminum or steel, it's going to hurt those companies, which could force them to lay people off. There's only 150,000 people who work in steel mills in the U.S. This policy is going to be good for them. But there are millions of people who actually who work in companies that use steel and aluminum. They make beer cans. They make soup cans. They make cars and cranes and boats and houses and industrial machines. And for them, this is bad. And for consumers of those products, this is bad. So just holding up a single can and saying, oh, well, this can, this tiny little can is going to be much more expensive, that's glib. That's not the right way to think about it.
It's
you
a good prop.
Expansively.
It looks good on TV, too.
Yeah. It is. It's a funny way to make the point.
Derek Thompson, senior editor at the Atlantic. Derek, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.